Oftentimes, it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education. And I should say we are not together today in the studio. We are, due to COVID-19 restrictions, still Zooming in, and our guest today will also be Zooming in.
Well, Denise, keep on developing Pope.
Keep on developing.
Keep on developing.
Is that a good thing? Keep on developing?
So it's a little different than keep on learning.
Okay.
Like development is more sort of maturational processes.
Okay. I like the sound of that.
You know,
that I'm maturing. That could be good or bad. This reminds me, Dan, and that's probably why you brought it up, of something called stage development theory. And I am going to ask you a question right now.
Okay.
Do you need me to talk about what it means? Do you want to tell the audience what it means, stage development theory? I want to know if you personally believe in stage development theory.
Do I like believe it in God? What?
Kind of, yeah. If you want to go that deep.
Do I think it's correct?
Do you think it's real? Do you think it's correct? Are you a believer?
Right.
So let's define it, because I think a lot of people, listeners, don't know.
You define it.
All right. So there are psychologists and other developmental scientists out there who believe that students, or actually anyone, goes through stages as they develop. And there's a couple of different people. There's Erikson, there's Freud, there's Piaget. Piaget is kind of famous for cognitive development stages. So you go through and you're kind of not ready to get to the next stage. You're not able to get to the next stage until you've hit a certain mark. And then you are ready to get to the next stage.
Ooh, I like that part. The fact that it's ordered.
It's ordered.
Yeah, I think I probably believe in stages, largely because a lot of people I know tell me that my humor is stuck in the teenage stages,
years. I would agree.
So maybe I'm there. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a stage.
Are you stuck in adolescence with the rest of your life too?
No, my joints are not, but I think it's pretty clear there's maturational changes. I mean, it's hard to look at puberty and think that's just a continuous change from what was before. I mean, and so it makes a lot of sense that those kinds of changes occur, and that suddenly, you know, if you're around kids, they suddenly seem to be able to do things that you can't explain where that came from. You know, and like suddenly they're able to think about hypothetical questions and things like that. And so that feels like some sort of jump that something must have changed, right? And the question is always, does some sort of jump in one area mean you jumped across lots of areas, right? Or is it just, you know, so there's certain periods of life where you learn language really quickly. I think it's—
When you're like, younger, when you're young. It's much harder to learn.
I think there's also somewhere around the age of 20, you also are very quick at learning new vocabulary.
Oh, I miss that.
No. Yes. That's why you've pursued English literature ever since to catch up.
Yes, exactly.
I think an interesting question is, are there stages like after puberty? So I had a student who was making the argument that there should be a new stage of early adulthood. It's like you've finished college, let's say, and now you're deciding, what should my life become? She was arguing, this is a very distinct stage with its own properties. It doesn't occur at other points in your life and so forth.
Well, one thing we do know about biology and the brain is your prefrontal cortex, particularly if you're male, is not fully formed until your very late 20s, right?
Is this where I start?
Is
this when I start making gorilla sounds?
Yeah, you know, if ever. No, so people are saying adolescence has gotten longer. Some people are saying part of that is the prefrontal cortex not fully forming until it's a little bit late.
Yeah. So probably, different biological systems come online, you know, so
how does this all relate to our speaker today?
Well, so I think a big question is, you know, as you get older and you have lots of experience, do you reach certain stages that aren't only marked by decline? but are marked by your abilities to look back and think about your life in ways that you just wouldn't have done, you know, and whether those are age dependent or you finally did retirement and so you have a chance to think about it, I don't know. Mm. But there do seem to be distinct changes. So, you know, as you get older, much older, you sort of tend to see the world with a little more calm, happiness, you know, and this is a steady change rather than a stage. Anyway, too much detail about smooth changes versus stage changes. I would like to introduce our expert, who really has been looking at development across the lifespan. And he's Bill Damon. He's a professor of education at Stanford. Welcome back, Bill. We had you once before. And last time we spoke about his scholarship around a purposeful life and developing a path to purpose. This time, we're talking about development in the later stages of life. And what occasioned bringing Bill back is that he recently published a new book, and it's called A Round of Golf with My Father. And we brought him back not because Denise has spent COVID learning how to play golf.
But that is true. And I'm into it. I'm totally into it.
Yeah, it's the last thing I want to do. After a day of being completely precise in everything, I'm going to go out and be precise again.
No, Dan, I think you might like it.
As the head of the golf club falls off. And anyway, this is about Bill. Bill has a really interesting story about his father and the implications for how we have a reflective life as we get older. So welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Dan and Denise. It's great to be with you guys again. And I loved the first part of your discussion. You could teach a whole course in developmental psychology out of what you guys were talking about.
I think so. Well,
I would say you could teach a whole course in developmental psychology.
So Bill, what is the premise of the book?
Well, number one, the premise is that the past matters. And actually, not only for folks with long pasts, such as some of us as you get older, but even for younger people, the way you think about your history of successes and failures in life makes a big difference to how you think about your future. How do you think about what you want to do next in life? And one of the messages of the book, as you said, it is about the later periods of life and thinking about not only what has happened in your life, but even what's happened in your parents' lives. But even as you get older, you have a future. And it's very important to think about your past in the right way, because it does affect how you think about who you are and what you want to do, what directions you want to pursue in the future. I quote Faulkner in the book, who said famously, "The past is not dead. It's not even past." In other words, it's part of who we are now. And the book goes into ways about thinking about your past histories of success, failure, your past purposes, and thinking about them in a systematic way is very helpful in determining how you think about your future horizons.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Bill Damon, who has a new book out, A Round of Golf with My Father. And this reflection was very interesting, Bill. You have a really unique story. Can you just give us a little snippet of sort of what caused you to go back and do this reflection?
Sure. And it is unique, but not as uncommon as even I originally thought. My father was always missing from my life. My mother gave me the story that he was, quote, missing in World War II. And I assumed that meant that he was killed in action or died on some nameless European front. And when I was in college, finally, she revealed to me that he had not died in World War II, but rather he had abandoned us. And that was all I wanted to know. And so when I was in college, I learned that he had continued to be alive, but I figured he was kind of a no-account scoundrel who drifted off in some way. And I did not want to identify with him. I was beginning to learn enough about developmental psychology to know that father-son identifications are pretty important. And so I was uninterested, and more than uninterested, I batted away every clue that arose from my college years onward. My daughter discovered, when I had reached my 60s, fairly late in life, she got interested and she did some online searches and found out that he actually had quite a significant life. He was dead at that point, but he had gone into the Foreign Service. He had remarried. He had daughters. And this triggered off in me a lot of curiosity at that point. I was ready to learn about this at that point. I wasn't threatened by information. And not only that, I was fascinated to learn that he actually had a pretty substantial life of contribution. And so I started a five-year research project where I interviewed all the people who were still alive, who knew him. I discovered my half siblings who are now parts of my family, which was a great thing for me. And I began doing what is known in the field of lifespan developmental psychology as a life review. And that gave me the material for the book that was not only personal, but also, some important messages about what's possible in psychological investigation on a personal level, in terms of, as I said before, thinking about your past in a systematic, intentional way that can give you a hopeful and purposeful future.
You know, I don't know if I would have done that. I think I would have been stuck in the stage of sort of anger, dismissal, and you left me. Yeah. I have no interest in you.
I was in that stage for decades, Dan. And of course, you're younger than I am. And so maybe I was finally ready for it. I was not ready for it at age 40, at age 50, and so on.
It's your daughter that made you ready for it, right? She pushed you on this.
That's right. This is one of the many ways that people can learn from their children.
Yeah.
And that was certainly true for me.
But I like have zero nostalgia. Like I don't have pictures of my children or my child on the refrigerator in the house. So it's sort of not in my nature to look backwards.
Yeah.
And don't worry, my son doesn't listen to the podcast, so I can say this.
No, but Dan, you tell so many stories on this podcast of your past. So I'm going to push you on that. I think you do.
They're all made up.
Oh, they are not. They are absolutely not.
Also, okay, I want to make 3 points here. Okay, number one, the last point, they're all made up. All of memory is to some extent made up. Ooh. That's very important to know. And I write about Piaget. You mentioned Piaget. He tells an amazing story of a childhood memory he has of being almost kidnapped. It turns out that memory was totally constructed, although he believed it for most of his life. He discovered it because the nursemaid who told him the story wrote a deathbed letter to the parents apologizing for making the story up.
That's
fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. She said she made it up to get extra rewards from the family. Piaget remembered it, every detail of it, as if it were true for his whole life until he got that letter. So memory is always partly a construction, number one. Number two, Dan, you mentioned I was full of the same kind of anger, resentments, some of them buried. And I quote Frank Sinatra in the song that he sings, regrets I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. And I always thought this is a plucky, don't look back attitude. It's a good thing. As I discovered in life, it's not so great to live with resentments and regrets that are unresolved. It is painful to confront them. It's difficult, but it gives you a certain peace of mind and helps you understand who you are and helps you learn from the regrets rather than just kind of bury them and forget about them. So I actually feel that I've become a more learning-oriented, open-minded, curious, and resolved person because of what, in a sense, my daughter pushed me to do. So I went through all of the reactions that you had, for sure, for decades. But I think it's better to confront things that are difficult rather than to avoid them.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are having a fascinating conversation with Bill Damon about his new book, Around a Golf with My Father, looking at lifespan developmental psychology, right? When you get to a certain point in life and you're looking back, and Bill, you're making a connection that even young people can do this. Do you think that's true?
Well, that's right. And because every student, college student or even high school student, has a history of failure and success. Everybody has failed. And we know two things about failure. We know that the way you think about failure is very important for your learning. That's something we've learned from Carol Dweck's work, having a growth mentality, and that the failure doesn't say something about you. It doesn't say you are stupid. It says things are hard, they're difficult. And if you think about them as learning opportunities, the failure has taught me something I need to learn better. I need to a gap that in my knowledge that I need to learn about. That's a growth mentality. And so how you think about your failures, that you can learn from them rather than they tell you that you were a stupid person, that's really important. And the successes you've had, the high points, they give you messages about things that mean a lot to you, that you can contribute, that possibly purposes you've had that have been rewarding and gratifying. And so thinking about those in an intentional way give you a message about follow-ups, about things you can do more of. So younger people too can learn to think about their past in a intentional, systematic way that gives them ideas about where to go in the future and how to learn from things that haven't worked. And as I said, failures, I mean, every successful entrepreneur or anybody else has said, you know, I wouldn't be where I was today if I hadn't tried things and failed and learned from them. So it's never too early to figure that out. And so I do think that young people can be coached in a way that they can think in a developmental, learning-oriented way about their past histories.
You know, you just reminded me, there's a project at Stanford called the Resilience Project, where they videotape famous professors and people like me who are not that famous and ask about your greatest failure and have you talk about it and say what you learned from it in order to show it to all these college students who come in and are freaking out about their first low grade or, you know, stress over the roommate or whatever. So that just reminded me of that piece,
yeah.
Bill.
That's a terrific approach. Yeah, I think that's the right way to go.
School's In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Bill Damon talking about life review and reflecting and lifespan developmental psychology next on Sirius XM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Bill Damon, who spent 5 years looking back at his past, doing a systematic life review that ended up in a really fascinating book called A Round of Golf with My Father.
You say that it can be a systematic life review, and I'm trying to imagine what that is. So I'm not so creative on this. In one model, I'm in a dark room with the lights off, and I'm trying to remember the past, and I'm not quite sure what to do when I remember it. Another version, I'm going through a box of letters, and they help me remember my past, and then I'm still not quite sure what I'm supposed to do with my past once I remember it. So sure. Any tips?
Sure. Well, first of all, what you want to be looking for are things that have been meaningful to you, things that at any point in your life you have found satisfaction and felt that this is what I am contributing to the world in some way. This is sort of why I'm here. So it's the why question that you want to ask. But you've got to get out of that room by yourself and go out and find some people that had spent time with you. If you're a young person or at any age, one source is teachers. Visit your sixth grade teacher and talk about what happened and what kind of learning experiences, and maybe even get some ideas if you can get a hold of school records. That's what I did was I went back to my school and found lots and lots of records of things that I had done and what counselors had written about me that I had no memory of at all. But it gave me a sense of, these are the things that I was interested in. These are things that people told me about, wrote about me. These are projects that I did that still there were records of. Friends and family, talking to friends that you had when you were younger, talking to still living relatives, if your father or grandfather or grand aunt are still alive, and talking about the kinds of experiences that shaped you, that influenced you, the kinds of activities you did that made a difference for yourself and for other people. So that's a big part of the life review. And of course, other parts have to do with possible recollections that you've had that you may be not so certain about, but try to write them out, and write them out in a way that gives you some sense of why they're important. Why are these important parts of your life? Either for the positive or the negative. They're important because I accomplished something, or they're important because I made a huge mistake. And everybody makes mistakes, but what did I learn from that mistake? And how can I get the benefits from it? And maybe even how can I avoid making similar mistakes moving forward? I learned that I was really stubborn, that this is something people told me about, would say about me when I was a freshman in high school. And I realized, you know, being stubborn is not the greatest thing in the world. And maybe I've become a little bit less of a stubborn person since that was revealed about me. So that's just one example of something forward.
So one of the things I've been interested in, Bill, is how do we create experiences for students that kind of create lifetime memories, right? So if two people go in the woods and they get lost together and then they find their way out together, they're lifetime friends, right? And the memory sticks forever. And so I've been trying to figure out how to do this. How do we create in safe experiences?
No, wait, why wouldn't any educator want to create really positive, wonderful memories? I don't think that's not what you're asking, Dan. Is that what you're asking?
Is he asking how or why?
No. I'm asking for the specific goal of when I reach 70, yeah, and I'm going to be looking back on my life. As an educator, should I set up certain kinds of experiences that allow me when I'm 70 to look back and capitalize on those experiences to make sense of myself?
Yeah, that's a yes. Maybe I'm sharing Denise's question, which is, the answer is of course. And if the question is how, I'll just give you one. I mean, this, you obviously need to be creative, and it has to do with what discipline you're teaching and everything else. But one guideline would be, do things that take a while. Don't break it up into little, I mean, a lot of classroom stuff or small lessons that come and go, but projects. I'm a huge fan of projects, serious long-term projects that require a lot of persistence, diligence, grit, all of those kinds of qualities that are hard to do, that make a difference. And if they can even connect with the community, a project where that then the student would write up and maybe send off in some little way to a blog or a local newspaper or the school newspaper, things that really matter. And if they can also make a contribution to other people or be involved with other people, all of that is going to increase the likelihood that these experiences are going to be memorable. And experiences that are memorable are good learning experiences. So my answer is yes, educators ought to do that. They ought to do that by investing time and resources in the student, having patience, not having quick projects that end right away and lead to quick evaluations, but rather that really invest the student in something that matters to the student and the world beyond the student.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with Bill Damon about making really memorable experiences as educators. And one of the things I do in a workshop all the time, which is sort of fascinating, is I ask educators to think back on a really memorable school experience when they were positively engaged, not a really sad one, although it would also work, I think, with sad or frustrating. And they, that's exactly what they remember, Bill. They remember things that they either that were really hard and challenging, that they took a long time, but they were so happy that they got through, or that they did with someone else and they formed a lifelong friendship, to your point, Dan, or it was very different. It didn't feel like school, or it had a real world outcome, like they created a mural that still stands today. So I think those things would all help with a life review for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
And Dan, did we answer your question? I feel like you're getting at something else. No,
no, no. Yeah? No. I thought it was a good answer. It gave me a sense of the sorts of activities I should create.
And every discipline.
Create lasting memories. It's different than learning to type, right? If I'm learning to type, the idea is lots of monochromatic repetition, which a lot of school is.
And
the point is, those are not the things you're going to remember, except for if you did like got an A on the typing test.
But those are also the things that cause you to learn more. I mean, there's a real connection between engagement and cognition.
Yeah, but if you want me to learn to type, project-based may not be the best.
And I think there's a role for learning. There's a role for learning discrete skills for sure. And you want students to come out of school eventually learning how to spell and stuff like that. But every discipline, whether it's art, science, you can have science projects, you can have art projects, every discipline, oral histories, you can teach anything in terms of a meaningful, long-term, challenging project that students can be involved in. And those are the things that the students remember for decades later, for sure.
Okay, Bill, so what is a project that you remember as you did this life review? Did you come upon something you said, wow, I forgot about that? I
grew up in Brockton, Massachusetts, which was a down-at-the-heels factory town where all the shoe factories had gone bust during the Depression. And I interviewed all my older relatives. At that point, my grandparents were still alive and everybody else, about the effect of that, how that affected their lives and so on. And I remember that project to this day. And not only that, I got my paper published in the Brockton Enterprise, the local newspaper, which was a thrill. And that kind of hooked me on doing research and writing. This was a research project. So it probably even affected my choice of a career later going forward.
Bill, thank you so much for being here. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.